You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
My name is Samuel Fuller. I'm directing a picture here in Portugal. First of all, the most important thing to me, every morning, every night, whether I'm writing or directing, preparing something or thinking about it, whether it's a drive or a talent or a hobby or fun, is to hit hard on one word, which only the camera can really do, and that's emotion. There is nothing that can get as close to an eyeball, where the entire one eye, where the pupil of an eye can fill a screen. That's why, to me, it's one of the greatest arts in the world. And as far as I'm concerned, to give you an example of what you can do with a camera, and you can do anything. And we are now only in the early ages, both of civilization and movie making. Imagine 500 years or 1,000 years from now. Oh, they will laugh at this like gladiators fighting in the Colosseum. All directors have their own tricks, their own likes and dislikes. I generally write my scripts, and I am very familiar with the character, and he always comes first. No trick with my character. I may have a trick on how he handles action. I may have a trick on how he makes an entrance or an exit or where to put the camera. But generally, I do my damnedest to make sure there's a reason for that. For instance, I don't like establishing shots. I just hate a shot that shows a city or a street and nothing happens. I don't mind an establishing shot even of a mountain. I don't care. That's a beautiful shot. Snow, beautiful. If in that shot you pull back and there's a little lovely lady, and she says to her son, "Isn't this lovely? It's Switzerland." And he blows her head off. Yes. Something has to happen for me to have that full shot, is what I'm talking about. I don't know, I never made a picture where it was just an establishing shot. It would be against me. Because from newspaper backgrounds, and I'm trying to handle a camera like a newspaper, we begin the story with a lead. That's why I like a punch opening. That's what you do. John so-and-so, age 51, killed his wife, his mother, his father, and 4 children. Period. That's the beginning of a new story. Insane man runs amok. That would be the headline, see? I like to get that feeling even in any kind of a picture, to get right in on it, even though it's necessary in many, many stories where you have to have a very, almost Renoir or Monet or Manet flavor, easy going. But even then, before I cut, something would have to happen, because I'm not creating anything, even the mood.
Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have my honorary co-host returning to the show. Miss Stephanie Crawford is back. She's delighting me with her presence yet again. Thank you, Steph.
Thank you. I like how you ended all of those sentences with a question mark.
I just don't want you to like, because people don't know that, like, you underestimate your own popularity on the show. What I was going to say, I had planned it in my head, but of course I screwed it up, is listener favorite, Just the Disc listener favorite, Stephanie Crawford, is back. Yeah, see, I knew you wouldn't like that, but it's the truth. You know, the numbers don't lie. You don't see the numbers, but I do. But a lot of people like your episodes, so that was how I was going to introduce you. But anyway, we are back talking classy stuff. We talked Gun Crazy and Wild at Heart last time, and this time we are talking about a director that we both love, not unlike David Lynch. Well, he's very different from David Lynch, but as far as our affection, he's somebody we both care for a great deal, and he's definitely his own auteuristic, you know, makes his own movies that are, you know, truly his kind of guy, and that is Mr. Sam Fuller. Steph, what was the first, when were you first exposed to Sam Fuller's gloriousness?
Well, when I first got into the Criterion Collection, I got a little bit addicted and I was just going scattershot. I just wanted to watch everything. And so I got to Shot Corridor and The Naked Kiss.
Nice.
And I was blown away. Yeah. I don't know if I fully trust a person who wouldn't be blown away from those films, but they were so gorgeous, but audacious, but they didn't feel exploitative. You can tell immediately with Sam Fuller, he has a point of view and he's fully invested in that point of view. So The Naked Kiss became my favorite.
Nice.
But after that, I got to Pick Up on South Street, which is my number one favorite overall and probably my favorite noir.
Wow. See, that's why you're, you know, on this show as much as you are, is because we're very simpatico. That is my favorite.
You remind me of me. How about you come back on the show?
I just want, you know, like-minded folks. Yeah, but, you know, that one is great. And, I, you know, it's not part of this set, but it is definitely worth tracking down the Masters of Cinema Blu-ray. I think there's just still just a Criterion DVD in the States, right? As far as I know.
For Pickup?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a great, great pick. It's so, I don't know. It's how, I was trying to think about like how to describe, if I had to describe Sam Fuller to someone without showing them one of his movies, like I was, it's not like I was going to have no way to do that, but like, what would be some things that you would use to get across the sort of the experience that he gives you with his films?
Well, it might be that that famous line from Pick Up on South Street, which is, "You waving the flag at me?
If you refuse to cooperate, you'll be as guilty as the traitors that gave Stalin the A-bomb."
Are you waving a flag at me?
Because I do think that sums him up. Sam Fuller was a man who was very patriotic. Well, I'm not going to use the word patriotic. I apologize. He loved his country. He loved the people in the country. But as it is with people who truly love America, they want it to be better. They see the underbelly. They see what's going on. They see the injustice. Instead of just trying to brush it under the rug so it looks nice for the guests, they're like, they lift that rug up and like, look at these cockroaches. They're not going anywhere unless we do something about them. And he just shoves the camera at those cockroaches.
Yep. Yeah, he is unafraid and almost duty-bound in his own way to expose that stuff. And part of that comes from a very unique background as a filmmaker. Now, there are a lot of, I don't want to say a lot, but there are definitely a good chunk of post-World War II filmmakers who actually served in World War II or World War I. Did some kind of military service and came back and made movies. And often they were changed by said experience. Sam is one of those people. However, he had a career as a crime reporter prior to that. So he was a newspaper man. Well, he started as a copy boy. He started selling newspapers, moved up to copy boy, became, I think, a crime reporter when he was like 17 years old. And so he had a unique on-the-ground perspective of America. I mean, he was in New York, and so he was learning, I think, about, you know, people and, again, the sort of fabric of, you know, what America was, at least in terms of what it how New York represented it in the period he was growing up. And he was seeing it through the eyes of a newspaper reporter, and specifically crime. So I think that brings, like, this incredible, unique perspective that he has about telling stories and giving the different sides of the stories. But yeah, that's that thing you're talking about of being unafraid and feeling compelled to sort of expose things and to show, you know, a movie all about a criminal. Like Pick Up on South Street is about a pickpocket who basically ends up with some microfilm that he's lifted off a woman's purse in a subway. And then, you know, you just go through this whole thing about, you know, is he going to help the sort of federal folks with getting the film back? And does he care? You know, is he a nation as a America first kind of guy? No, he's not. He's a me first kind of guy. And that's what I love about it. He makes these characters that are very true to themselves in a way that I think I was used to seeing in film noir, but only in the villains. And his main characters are just, they're more complex than that, I think. I'm sure that's something you noticed too.
Absolutely. And I can't tell you how many films I've watched and how many books I've read where I was so much more interested in the supporting characters than I was the main characters. And Sam Fuller seems to understand that there's so many crime movies that they either follow the cops or they do follow the gangsters, but, you know, it's in a very kind of one note way. And he's like, well, I actually know the alleyways. I actually know the person you have to talk to the person to find the guy on the top. And they're all living really interesting little lives. They're just trying to scratch out their existence, and they all have stories. And he continually shined a light on people like that, the people I've always been interested in and want to hear more about. And that is one of my favorite things about him. He recognizes that a lot of people are marginalized by society, but he doesn't marginalize them. He's like, well, I think you're great. Oh, no one else is paying attention to you. That's, fuck it, let's make this story about you. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, me too. I mean, it's, again, I don't know if that comes from the point of view of a newspaper reporter who's like, you know, where's the story here? Who is the quote-unquote character that I'm interested in here, and who do I think a reader would be interested in? And yeah, it's, there's just something about that approach that really, it doesn't seem quite as revolutionary now. I think partially because he's influenced so many people over the years, you know, including Martin Scorsese in a huge way. Quentin Tarantino is a huge fan. The late Curtis Hanson's a huge fan. I mean, he's got Tim Robbins is all over the special features of this. By the way, we're talking about the Indicator Sam Fuller Blu-ray set. Eventually, we'll get to that. But, you know, he's had a lot of influence. And I think that a lot of modern, quote unquote, modern crime films of today and the 70s are influenced by, in some ways, his perspective on criminals and giving them sort of a more well-rounded opportunity to exist in a movie and not just be the heavy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think you're totally right in terms of like just those characters that he finds interesting and the way that I still can't believe that he, you know, he's thought of as an independent filmmaker in a lot of ways. And he did have that in the 60s. I think I had the same first exposure that you did. I think Shock Horror was first for me and then Naked Kiss. Those are definitely the first two. Also because of the Criterion Collection. But then come to find out, you know, you see Pick Up on South Street and you see some of the films we're going to talk about today. And he's working within the studio system. You know, he is a lot of his films were made, these are Columbia films, but a lot of his work was done under Daryl Zanuck. And I think that's fascinating, you know, that there was a place for him that Zanuck was able to see the, I don't know, the very unique voice that Sam Fuller had and, you know, became sort of, I don't want to say like his Woody Allen, but like definitely a guy that he was willing to bankroll, even if it meant alienating portions of his viewership, you know? There's a great story that Sam tells about the Crimson Kimono, which we'll get to a little later, where, you know, Zanuck really had to just kind of go, okay, talking to one of his bean counters, like, how many states won't even play this movie about this love triangle between a Japanese-American cop and a white cop and this woman you know, who are we going to lose here? And then basically deciding, okay, we're going to make it anyway. I just think that there's something, I mean, I'm not surprised, because when you see Sam Fuller interviewed, he is a character to end all characters. I mean, he is one of the most fascinating storytellers in person. And he's able to bring that to his filmmaking, which I think is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, even though he ran up against a lot throughout his career, mostly because of all the chances he took, he did enjoy kind of a special place where you'll hear horror stories about studios not letting certain people go, even though they don't want to do their work, but they'll still keep them under contract and kind of let them rot there. But I think Sam Fuller has a natural charisma and he's naturally savvy, but you do learn how to talk and read people and manipulate them a little bit in journalism. And I think that came in handy quite a bit. So he was just kind of able to go from studio to studio and not really harbor any ill will. It was just kind of going wherever it worked. And if it didn't work with them, he made it independently.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy the career that he had. I mean, he didn't make a ton of movies, but the ones he did make, like I said, they all have this very Fuller stamp on them through the characters and through the dialogue, which is both like very hard-boiled and film noir-y, I guess, but like more energetic even than film noir dialogue in some ways. More, I don't even know how to describe what he does with his characters, because I feel like you watch enough film noir and you're kind of like, oh, they're in that film noir lingo. And every once in a while you hear like a really fun turn of phrase and, you know, that'll kind of keep you going with it. But Fuller's like dialogue is just so, I don't know, it's this mix of like earnest melodrama and cleverness that I think is just so interesting, you know, because like there's part of you that wants to laugh at some of the dialogue, but you know that he doesn't necessarily, like, he means it, you know, and there's just a way about that that is really intimate for me, in because you could just check out, I guess, if you wanted to, if you're looking at it as just another old movie. But boy, he can really hook you, you know, and again, emotionally, in bringing you into the characters that he's created with that melodrama. I don't know, there's some magic to it, I think, just the alchemy that's involved.
I don't think it can be overstated how much his journalism background impacted that. I think he had a wonderful combination of having that background, learning that you need multiple sources, that you need to talk to everyone, that you cannot look over anyone if you want to be any good as a journalist. If you want to get the full story, you need to talk to everyone. You need to go into their neighborhood, see how they're living, and talk to them, whatever level they are, whether socioeconomic place they're at or where they're from. You need to learn how to talk to them respectfully and really get the story. But on top of that, I also think he was a romantic, and I think he was very empathetic, and it is just this beautiful marriage together. And there are writers I enjoy, but I'll read them, or I'll see enough of their films, and I'll kind of realize that everyone kind of talks the same. Whether it's a middle-aged man and a teenage girl, there'll be similarities that really shouldn't be there. And I've never picked that up from Sam Fuller. He does have a style with his dialogue, obviously, but every character, you can instantly imagine them in their own world.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's always a sense of, I don't know about always, but there's definitely a sense of mistrust. There's a great documentary that sort of plays into the special features on this Blu-ray set. It's called The Typewriter, the Rifle, and the Movie Camera. And it's only about an hour long. I think it's on YouTube. Mm-hmm. It features Tim Robbins, Quentin Tarantino, Jim Jarmusch, and it's Tim Robbins interviewing Sam Fuller and kind of going through his career, and then Tim Robbins and Tarantino going through his old house, I think, in the States right before he left the country. He had some problems making White Dog and then bailed.
It does seem like they're just rummaging through his stuff.
They totally are. And they're having a blast doing it. They're finding you know, the kendo sticks from Crimson Kimono and like the book jacket from his first novel. And anyway,
the helmet.
It's a really great documentary.
The helmet.
But one of my favorite things is that then they intercut these little clips of Jim Jarmusch talking, and the Jim Jarmusch stuff is some of my favorite stuff.
When you're a reporter, you are not a god. You're not even a reporter. You're not a recorder. You're not a camera. And a camera can lie, too. It's a question to a goddamn shadow. Because in the shadow is the killer, but he's not seen. So you see, the photograph of a killer does not exist. It's black. He says, remember those things when you're on a story. And don't let take anybody's word, including your mother's. If she's a nice woman, that boy, why, he wouldn't hurt a fly. Don't believe her. Don't insult her, but don't believe her. Don't believe yourself. When you talk to relatives and friends of anybody who's involved in a story, don't believe them. Go to their enemies. Don't believe them. What you have to do is weigh.
And that is constant for him. I've said things to him that, well, so-and-so said this to me, and he'll say, well, who the hell is so-and-so? What does that mean to me? I don't give a shit about so-and-so. Did you see it? No, I didn't, but I heard. Oh, you heard. Well, that means nothing to me. You know, he doesn't care about what you heard. He still has that thing about, if I experienced it, then I understand, at least I understand the experience from my point of view.
It's this whole thing of like sort of, even when you have the full story from multiple sources, that you still can't trust all those sources. Like, the real truth is very difficult to find. And I feel like there's a sense of him exploring that idea in a lot of his movies. You know, it's definitely part of him, you know, this sense of like, we can, even when we've been a part of something, we are, our perspective is skewed our own way. It's just a really fascinating perspective, and one that I wouldn't necessarily have unless I had some journalistic experience. And I guess specifically the kind that he got back then, you know?
Yeah, that was real, like, old New York City getting into the dirt journalism.
All right, well, let's talk about some of these movies here. We've got...
Oh, okay.
Well, unless you want to say some more stuff about...
No.
Because I think we'll talk about him more, and some of the stuff that we've been talking about plays into a lot of what these movies sort of exemplify. This box set, it's from our friends at Indicator. It's all region, and it has 7 movies in it. And I'm sure there's some of you who got the Sam Fuller DVD set from Columbia years ago, and it is, in essence, that set transferred to Blu-ray. However, they've added a lot of extra stuff to it. So I think that's part of the reason it's kind of a must-own. But so the 7 movies are broken up as such. You have 3 shorter films that Sam wrote on the first disc. It Happened in Hollywood, Adventure in Sahara, Power of the Press, that's on one disc, and then 2 more that he wrote that were directed by some cool folks. The first one is called Shockproof, directed by Douglas Sirk, and then one called Scandal Sheet, which was directed by Phil Carlson. And then the last 2 discs are his movies, Crimson Kimono and Underworld USA. So let's start with these shorties, if you will. Each one is about an hour long, and they range from 1937, 38, and 1943. The first one is It Happened in Hollywood.
Action!
What a night. Or maybe I'm seeing it through different eyes.
Are you, darling? I'm so happy.
Your hair is like moonlight, imprisoned in a gossamer web. If I was to tell you...
Cut it!
You know, I don't reckon I'll ever get them wuzzes and whirs untangled.
Put on the work light, boys. Tim, this is Mr. Forsythe. He's here to help you with your dialogue.
Hardy, how do you do? If you don't mind, perhaps I can give you some assistance.
Of course he don't mind. That's what you're here for, aren't you?
If you'll just give me the script, Mr. Howard. If you don't mind, Mr. Bennett, please. And if you'll just relax, Mr. Howard, and let me have the stage for a few moments. Thank you. Now then, my dear fellow, you bend over this lovely creature. No, you You just take this gift and I'll show you. You watch me. The magic scent from her hair. Oh, pardon me, I'm Mr. Forsythe. You are overwhelmed with her exquisite beauty. You cry out. It pains you.
Well, don't pain me none to look at Glory.
My dear Mr. Bard, can't you imagine that you love this girl?
Well, that don't take no imagination. I wouldn't tell her all these fancy words you got here. I'd just say it. I'd just tell her the first time I ever laid eyes on her, I knew I'd never be looking at another woman from then on.
Come on, come on, Tim. I paid $25,000 for this play. If it's good enough for Broadway, it's good. Certainly is. Now, let's get on with this.
My dear chap, don't let that make you nervous. As I was saying, you delve into your very soul.
Delve?
Now, this one is kind of like... I mean, I think because of the length and because Sam's not directing them, they definitely feel different than, you know, actual Sam Fuller movies. But you can feel things about them, especially Power of the Press in a big way. But this one in particular is sort of a light dramedy.
Yeah.
About two actors played by Richard Dix and Faye Ray. And they are adapting to, they're silent screen actors adapting to the coming of sound. And Richard Dix's character is a cowboy, Western actor, and Faye Ray's character is, I mean, she isn't quite as pigeonholed as he is, I don't think. But so he starts to lose work once the sound kicks in, and then, you know, she continues to get work and tries to get him work, and he starts to sort of... He starts a little bit of a downtrend, but ultimately it ends in a happier place. It's a little sentimental overall. I don't know. What did you think of this one?
Yeah, as far as downward spirals go, it was a curly fry. It didn't get too dark. But this was apparently his first screen credit.
More fast food analogies, please.
I'll do my best.
And oh, is it his first screen credit? Oh, great. I didn't even notice that. That's great.
So his story, even though it's a bit of a trifle. No, that's not fast food. I need to try again.
I like it. We went British, too.
It is great to just have as part of his history. So I guess they knew the old Western star, Tom Mix, who was big in silent Westerns. And it's basically his story. He had like a tough transition into talkies. And so he basically took that actual situation and made Singing in the Rain. No, I'm sorry. It happened in Hollywood.
Yeah. No, there's definitely, you know, similarities to Singing in the Rain in terms of the whole transitional period thing. I don't know. I liked this movie, but ultimately it's a little slight. I think the best part is, without giving too much away, there's a point when the main character has to throw a party, and he wants to impress this young kid who was looking up to him, and who he wants the kid to think that he's still connected to Hollywood. So he basically gets a bunch of folks that have been stand-ins for famous, you know, celebrities mm-hmm. of the time, Charlie Chaplin, W.C. Fields, Mae West, and they all show up at this party at this ranch, and they're hijinks do ensue, and it's super cute. It's a really cute scene, and it almost saves the movie from total slightness. But yeah, ultimately, it's one of the weaker ones in the whole set, but it's still worth seeing for sure.
Yeah, and if you want to see a connection between Sam Fuller and Harmony Korine, then you have the Mr. Lonely thing with all the celebrity impersonators.
That's right. Wow. Good pull. I hadn't thought about that. So that is...
It was a reach. Oh,
no,
a
I
reach.
Think it's... I'm sure you've seen it. So that is It Happened in Hollywood. Next is Adventure in Sahara from 1938.
And you don't say Sahara?
Sahara.
Over here in Las Vegas, there's a major street called that, and everyone says Sahara.
That's great.
But we also don't say Nevada.
Oh, what do you guys say?
Nevada.
Okay, good. That is weird, though. Sahara. I might have to take that up. This one is about a young guy who, at the beginning of the movie, he's a pilot. He gets a letter. It says, your brother has died in the French Foreign Legion. And he freaks out and he goes and joins the French Foreign Legion to figure out what happened. But I think he already knew, basically, that the sort of commandant, the head guy in this particular unit, is awful and tortures his men and pushes them to the point of death, basically.
Why aren't you working?
You see, sir...
Silence! Move your carcass out of here. Polish those boots. Report to me in an hour.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So, these are the reinforcements. I asked for legionnaires. They sent me unweaned whelps and gibbering old men. What is this, only 16?
We lost 12 on the march, sir.
You lost 12? Before I had a chance to make soldiers of them. Your name?
James Wilson, sir.
American. Have we ever met before?
I don't think so, sir.
What is this mess? Here, the first lesson is neatness.
He's a new recruit, sir.
No excuse. He will learn to arrange his kit properly. Fort Agadez is no place for a dreamer, my puppy.
But it is mine. You have no right...
Again, one thing you must learn immediately. We are under orders of war, and at Fort Agadez, I am the law. The puppy's name?
Malraux, sir.
Malraux. Punishment for insubordination is 2 weeks solitary confinement, sentenced to begin at sunset. You will have time to dream, my friend, on bread and water. And you will learn to obey without complaint. Perhaps this lesson has been worthwhile. To impress upon you that this is no playground. We are at war. In the desert, bands are massing for attack. At any moment, we may be fighting desperately for our lives. I understand you ran into a few ambitious idiots that tried to escape from this outpost. You saw what happened to them? Don't forget it. Make up your minds to one thing. If you go to fight, you go into action as savants, legionnaires. Train to the teeth and no weaklings. I shall make legionnaires out of you, or crush you in the attempt.
So it becomes this whole mutinous battle between this guy and the sort of headman, and it gets complicated, and it didn't end in a way that I found as satisfying, although there were some surprises that were interesting, but ultimately I was annoyed.
Wow.
I don't know, I think you know what I'm talking about. There's like a thing where you're just like, okay, you know, comeuppance, yes, and then it's not quite that. And you know, I like that a movie doesn't do what you expect, but at the same time I was like, okay, well, now it's the resolution is ultimately a little flaccid, if you will.
Yeah, you don't have to do what I expect, but can you do something?
But it, you know, it's a movie with a message, and you know, it's still good and interesting, and you know, worth looking at. And I feel like you can feel the Fullerisms in it, in terms of the way that he's approaching how the military should work and how, you know, the chain of command should work, and that there should be a mutual respect. And you know, there's definitely something there that's Fullery. But I think my favorite of this disc for sure is the next movie, Power of the Press, from 1943.
I don't get to say anything about about Adventure in Sahara.
Let's go back. What did you think of Adventure in Sahara?
Well, I'm pretty much on the same page as you. I just thought it was funny that Sam Fuller was talking to the head of Columbia at the time, who hadn't seen Mutiny on the Bounty.
Oh.
So Fuller was basically telling him about it. He's like, oh, that sounds great. Go write that. So he kind of did a not plagiarized version of that.
That's so funny. Yeah, there's definitely some big time similarities between this and Mutiny on the Bounty.
Yeah, okay, do you know the Frank Darabont movie, The Majestic?
Yes.
This feels like that Bruce Campbell movie within the movie. I think it's like, I think it even had, yeah, like Sam Pirates of the Sahara.
Let her go. I find your persistence tiresome. I get that a lot.
Oh, wow.
It just feels like
that
movie within the movie in The Majestic to me.
Oh, I got to go back and watch The Majestic now, which I actually don't mind. I think it got a bad rap when it came out.
I'm a fan of it.
Yeah, I think it got a little beat up when it came out for being, again, maybe overly sentimental. And, you know, but people were comparing him to Capra, which it very much is a Capra-esque kind of thing, which I don't think
that's a terrible thing. No, to be inspired by Frank Capra.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there was just a little too much cynicism in the movie going public at that point, and they were not, and maybe they had expectations for Frank Darabont, I don't know. But yeah, I think it's a neat movie and an underrated Jim Carrey performance. And I forgot about the Bruce Campbell movie though. That's really cool.
That's the best part. But Charles Moore was in this and he worked with Capra, so look, I can find a connection anywhere. But I need to ask you something really quick.
Okay.
Did it basically seem like they played the Superman theme song in this movie? Because it was like the exact beginning of it. The da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then change.
I missed
that. But it kept happening. It drove me crazy.
It would start and then stop? Like,
yes, I kept expecting like George Reeves Superman to come in.
Well, John
Wayne. Don't worry, French Legion, Foreign Legion, that'll be an help.
Superman joins the French Foreign Legion.
I'm starting to think my mind wanders too much when I watch a movie.
No, but that's distracting. Now I'm going to have to like re-listen to that bit of score and see. I can't believe I missed it because I'm usually.
Man, it was so obvious to me.
I'm
and
sure
it kept
it's
happening.
There. I'm sure it's there. I was oblivious for some stupid reason. But I want to listen to it again. That's cool. That's a cool little. I'm trying to imagine John Williams watching French Foreign Legion movies, and
you never know.
Yeah, I'm sure it's very possible. You know.
Do you know him? Can you ask him?
I'm sure. I got him on text.
Use them hookups. Them PCP hookups.
We got him on Slack chat. You know, he's part of the PCP Slack chat. So I'll get him. I'll get him. Anyway, so Power of the Press, 1943.
Well, Howard Rankin isn't even a real newspaper man, not in any sense of the word. But because he inherited 45% of the Gazette stock, he can dictate the newspaper's policies. He can prove anything to the readers, especially if it's a lie. Journalistic ethics, honesty, which is the foundation of every decent newspaper, means absolutely nothing to him. He's the man who abuses the freedom of the press and misuses the power of the press. And with John Carter dead, he can go on doing it more and more, and there's no one to stop him. I think he's the most dangerous man in America.
Me trying to cope with him would be like... No, I'm just man enough to run the Star County World, and that's all I am. I couldn't carry on, even if I was fool enough to try. It's not for me.
It's much easier to tell people when they're wrong than to do anything about it, isn't it, Mr. Brett? Well, John Carter's dead because what you said mattered to him. But it doesn't seem to matter enough to you for you to leave your nice, quiet, safe little corner and step out and fight the people who killed him. You must be a very big man with your 1,244 readers, if there are that many. Well, if defending the freedom of the press and not misusing the power of the press meant anything more than just words to you, you'd take Mr. Carter's newspaper with its 2 million readers and you'd... Oh, I know about Charles Dana and Horace Greeley and your great-grandfather and all the rest of the great old-time editors. Mr. Carter told me about them, and they weren't afraid. But a mouse can't be an elephant. You're right, Mr. Bradford. You're right.
And this one is, again, there's, I don't know if I want to accredit it to a younger Sam Fuller, you know, maybe more idealistic. Although I feel like that there is a sense of cynicism and idealism commingling in a lot of his work, but this feels a little bit leaning more towards the idealistic and somewhat sentimental side. But basically, it's about a New York newspaper who's the guy who runs it commits suicide, and if I remember right, and leaves the paper to this guy who had basically threw an editorial in a small town paper, called him out on his bullshit, like the stuff that this New York paper had become. It used to be a great paper, and he was sort of calling him out about some stuff. And basically, the guy leaves the paper to this guy who runs this small paper in, I forget, somewhere outside New York. And so that guy has to be brought in to run this New York paper. And of course, he gets lots of resistance from the somewhat crooked powers that be that are in place there. And it's an interesting, there's like some slight similarities to His Girl Friday, because there's like this murder case where a man is like wrongly accused, and the paper has sort of made its position felt in a really big way. And I don't know, I found this movie really fascinating to watch from the point of view of right now. I mean, there's stuff about like fake news is literally said in this movie. You know, it's crazy. What did you think of this one?
Yeah, I'm a little of two minds about it. On one hand, I'm completely with you. It was so timely. It was a little infuriating. Like, come on, we can't still be this bad at this. Come on. And I think it, I'm with you. It's almost like when you have like your first year of college and you're suddenly enlightened and you know everything and you're like, but everything's wrong. We've all been living a lie. You got to listen to me. So I do think it's a concept he refines later on, and I won't get into it because we're going to talk about it, but within Scandal Sheet, there's definitely similarities there. But overall, the movie didn't fully connect with me, and I really wanted to. I thought it was such an interesting plot, and even though it's speechifying, I really liked it. There's that one quote, freedom of the press means the freedom to tell the truth, not the freedom to twist the truth. And I was like, that's right. That's right. That's exactly right. So yeah, this one sat so funny with me because there are parts of it that I loved and I admired. But overall, I almost have to remind myself of what happened. I don't know if it was just a lot of plot to cram into a really short running time with a lot of idealizing within it. And they were all just kind of fighting with each other. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, there's a lot crammed into the like 64 minute running time, which I kind of like, but which in an apparently lower budget movie like this, it really does make for just a lot of scenes of people talking, which is fine. And there are some good scenes in that sort of not Patton-esque, but you know, just like the small town paper guy is played by Guy Kibbe, who's a character actor from this period that I like a lot. I like him in comedies more than I like him in dramas, but he has some little speeches that, you know, like the stuff you're citing, and you know, there's just a lot about journalistic ethics, and he's really trying to stick to his guns, and it takes some like twisty, you know, clever plot stuff to try and come out with a just ending, if you will. And then, yeah, it's a lot to cram in, but yeah, I don't know. I guess it was interesting to watch I watched these movies basically in order. So it was interesting to see the slow evolution of the Sam Fuller voice. And this is getting closer to things like Park Row, which he would do later, and stuff like that. I mean, obviously he really refines it for Park Row, and that's a fully Sam Fuller movie. But yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting movie. I'm glad I saw it. But once we get into the next stuff with the next disc, which is Shockproof and Scandal Sheet, that's where it really starts to sort of take shape. Okay, well, we'll just talk about both of them, but. So Shockproof is the Douglas Sirk movie, and it's I can't remember what's the plot of this one. This is the one I'm forgetting.
A woman was just got out of prison.
Oh, yes, yes. Because
she
okay.
murdered for her boyfriend.
Yes.
She took the rap, and she gets out, and he's immediately back. But she's with her parole officer, who's a really good guy, and he's trying to help her get started again. But, you know, she has that poisonous ex-boyfriend just trying to pull her back into everything.
Yeah. And Cornell Wilde plays the parole officer.
Now then, you understand you're not permitted to drive a car. You're not permitted to drink alcoholic beverages. You may not borrow money. You may not carry a weapon. You may purchase clothes and food, but never on credit. All purchases must be for cash. Did you read this?
I've got it memorized.
And our objective is the rehabilitation of the criminal. We'll help you in every way we can, but it's up to you. I'll get you a job and a place to live. You cannot leave that job. You cannot
change... I change my employment or my place of residence without first obtaining the permission of the Bureau of Paroles.
Well, you have got it memorized. You may not enter into any contract without the consent of your parole officer. That's me. You may not marry. And you've got to change your brand of men.
Who picks them for me? You?
Don't worry, you won't have any trouble finding new friends. But be sure they're friends this time. Now, some of these matters, when conditions justify it, an exception can be made by special permission of the chief parole officer. However, no exception can be made to the rule of not carrying a deadly weapon or to the rule of not marrying. These are beyond our power to sanction.
You've got it all memorized, too, haven't you?
Well, I say it at least once a day.
You can save it. I know it all.
I can't help that. You're on life parole. Oh, hello, Sam. This is Jenny Marsh. Meet Mr. Brooks, our chief parole officer.
How do you do? Glad to be out, eh?
Yes, sir.
Now then, you're on life parole. That means you report to me every day.
Every day?
That's it. Later it'll be twice a week, then once a week.
How long does that go on?
Well, if you behave, you can get your lease in a couple of years. Remember him?
If I try hard enough.
Well, try hard to forget. He's dead. I mean, dead as far as you're concerned. He's got a bad reputation.
Oh. Yes, sir.
Now, listen. This is important in your case. You may not associate with or correspond with or make any contact with any individual of known bad reputation or any present or former inmate of a penal institution.
Harry Weston was
I know
never...
all about Harry. You don't have to tell me. He's never landed in the pen, but he's come close a dozen times. I'm telling you he's the wrong sort for you. My orders are to stay away. Disobeying my orders means you break parole. Breaking parole means you go back to jail. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
And he starts to fall for her, and things get really complicated. But yeah, this one is, I think, partially because of Cornell Wilde, but also partially because, I guess this is co-written by Fuller. I was going to say, I thought maybe it was just him that wrote it, but it definitely is starting to get into the more, like, seeing criminals as people kind of characters, like the, what this woman is going through and why she did what she did and how the movie tries to humanize her reasons for continuing to stay connected to her ex-boyfriend or her boyfriend, I don't know. And things get, like, more heightened and heightened until the end. And so, I don't know. I thought it was interesting. I think I like Scandal Sheet a little bit better. I'm not sure how you felt about these two.
I really enjoyed both of them.
Yeah.
Shock Proof, I had no idea Douglas Sirk directed it. It was really exciting for me. I'm a huge fan of him. But this was back in, like, you know, when he was directing things like Lured with Boris Karloff terrorizing yeah. Lucille Ball and not really, like, written on the wind melodrama Douglas Sirk. And he had some of those melodramatic flourishes, but I think when he was doing more genre kind of crime pictures early in his career, he had great restraint and a great timing for just when he was dealing with complicated relationships, and we have a bit of a love triangle in this one. And from where we start, it starts in almost a sweet place. You know, she's on parole. She just got out of prison, but we're really hopeful for her. And at the end, you know, it becomes like a on the lam picture.
Yeah.
But it builds so beautifully. And it's kind of surprising when I was at the end, I looked back, I was like, wow, we really went on a journey here, but it felt very natural.
Yeah, no, he definitely, I think that's the other thing that's interesting about the difference between the first disc stuff and the second disc. I'm looking at the director names, and, you know, Harry Lachman, I feel like I've heard of him, but D. Ross Lederman and Lou Landers are some of the directors on the early shorter films. And then once you get into the Douglas Sirk and Phil Carlson, you can definitely feel a more assured hand or a more interested party involved in the directing side, you know. And I think that's part of the reason a couple of those earlier films are a little flatter, is they just feel like somebody going through the motions a little bit, you know. Whereas these feel more fully directed, really. And yeah, you're right. It's neat to see Sirk in this period. You know, he's a really solid filmmaker, you know, and his melodramas are some of my favorites of all time. And he's definitely playing with elements of melodrama here for sure. But it's neat to see sort of a noir twist on it, you know, which is something that he would kind of bring into some of his movies a little later too. But the Scandal Sheet was the one that connected with me just a little bit more for some reason.
Well, Mrs. Raleigh, in defense of Mark Chapman,
Mr. Madison, I'd like to handle my own defense if you don't mind.
Yeah, just as you say, Mark.
Mrs. Raleigh, I think you and the other stockholders should know that your publisher hired me as executive editor with full rights to transform this newspaper. He did this for a very simple reason. He was fed up with operating at a loss. Why did Mr. Madison hire me? Well, he felt it was time that the Express buried its antiquated negative approach, such as this. But who won? And become a positive newspaper. We're in a business, ladies and gentlemen, a business of satisfying the hunger of the public for thrills, escape, and news. Here's where I took over your highly respectable White Elephant. Instead of headlining a UN story, we gave them a Vice story. Obviously, they went for it. We played down the presidential appointments, concentrated on the guerrilla man killings. Here's what happened. 30 or 40,000 new readers. Why, in a year, circulation's up over 110%.
And when we reach 750,000, we'll have to pay you a big bonus. I'm not sure I like this at all.
Did you like the dividend check you got last month for the first time in 12 years?
And I don't like this, sir. What kind of journalism is this? A newspaper staging a cheap, vulgar display in order to attract the stupid slobs of the city.
The thousands that will attend the Lonely Heart Dance tonight, these poor, friendly, unhappy people whom you call stupid slobs, buy and read this newspaper. Their loyalty helped put that dividend check in your pocket.
And I suppose you think it's a public service when one of your reporters is arrested for withholding information from the police? Or whatever it was? This, what's his name, McCleary person. And the things he writes about. I think he should be fired.
This McCleary person is the best young reporter I've seen in 25 years of newspapering. Before I'll fire him, I'll throw the Express up for grabs and go to work for somebody who appreciates real talent on a paper.
Oh, Mark, I'm sure.
One last thing. The only contract I have here is a handshake between Mr. Madison and myself. Now, unless you give me full rights to run this paper the way I want, I'll quit after the final edition today. Now, I'm sorry I can't stay with you any longer. I have a newspaper to get out.
And that one is... It reminded me of... like The Big Clock / No Way Out, you know. Basically, Broderick Crawford, he runs the newspaper. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, he kind of takes over as basically editor-in-chief.
Yeah, and then the paper sort of starts running down this story about a murder, and we've seen Broderick Crawford commit said murder, so it's kind of like this... when is he going to get caught? Is he going to get caught kind of scenario? And I don't know. I dug it. I thought it was a really interesting and gritty sort of, again, very noirish tale. And yeah, I mean, outside of the young reporter character who was played by John Derrick, I think, is the young reporter. He's a little annoying to me, although I can't tell if he's supposed to be like a Sam Fuller surrogate or what. But he was interesting, but a little overconfident, a little obnoxious. But Donna Reed is in this movie, which is kind of neat. Very younger Donna Reed. But yeah, it's just a sort of a fun thriller that, you know, has that element of like, we know who did it and it's just a matter of like, how is it going to shake out, you know? But you dug this too.
I did. And it's funny that you brought up John Derrick's performance, because I did think a few times like, huh, I wonder if it was kind of like with Hitchcock casting Farley Granger, where he just didn't like him at first, like, hey, you're too green and... Well, he's British. I don't know what accent I was trying to do there. You're kind of baby-faced and green, but then he ended up liking him. He had kind of that like plucky baby face.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, kind of charm, but you're kind of annoyed by him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's an interesting parallel. It could be a similar kind of scenario.
All I do know is that Sam Fuller did not like this movie.
Oh, I missed that.
Howard Hawks originally tried to make it, and they were going to have Bogart and Edward G. Robinson in it.
Wow.
And it didn't work out, and Howard Hawks ended up selling the script for 6 times what he paid Fuller for it.
Oh, shit.
So Sam didn't really get anything he wanted from this film, but I guess you could say it is more slight than it could have been.
Sure.
But I also think that's part of why I like it so much. It's almost like a low-key noir version of All the President's Men in the very specific way that it finds the entire process of finding out who done it, basically, through journalists instead of cops.
Yeah.
And that goes back to like interviewing people on the street. There's a drunk ex-journalist that they write off, but he can actually crack the whole thing. And Donna Reed's the only one who takes him seriously. There's so much character in here. I can understand, especially if you're going to work with Howard Hawks, why this would kind of bum you out. But I think it's tight. And Broderick Crawford in it is so wonderful at, you know, he's terrible. And when he switches that on, you're like, oh my God, no, get out of that room with him. But then when he's talking to all like the plucky young journalists in the newsroom, he's encouraging them and telling them, yeah, go out and get it. Like, you buy it. And it's brilliant. And it's really arresting. Like, it almost seems effortless how much he can juggle that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Which, okay, it's acting. But he's really good at it.
No, he is. And there's part of his delivery that almost feels like, I don't want to say forced, but it doesn't feel as naturalistic as it could, but somehow it works in this way that he's like this very gruff dude. I can't even explain how it works or why, but it really does somehow.
Well, because he knows he's living a lie. He's like there under assumed name. And I guess a kind of spoiler alert with this. Sorry. But I think there's a great tension they created with him knowing he's a liar. And he's surrounded by people who are thirsty for the truth. And they have energy on their side and they have truthfulness on their side. You know, and they might like word things to certain people like, you know, I'm not saying I'm a cop, but you may want to talk to me.
Yeah, there's some scummy stuff.
So I feel like if you're hiding that much and you're holding that big of a lie and you're surrounded by these shining faces, like, don't worry, we're going to get to the bottom of this. I think it'd be hard to act natural.
No, you're right. You're right. There is a sense of performance in his performance.
Is it a performative performance?
I guess. You know, like performance within performance, kind of. I was thinking one of the things I did write down was like I wrote 1952's version of Nightcrawler ? meets The Big Clock. So there's definitely a sense of like, you know, exploiting people, doing whatever you can to get your story, or in the case of Nightcrawler, to get the footage. And I also thought this would be a really interesting double feature with Ace in the Hole.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah, so if you're a fan of Ace in the Hole, it's no Ace in the Hole, don't get me wrong. But, like, you know, it just has those elements of cynicism and, you know, journalism together and a sort of a thrillery thing that made it. And the Broderick Crawford thing, I think, really carries it for me. So that was the stuff that compelled me about it, pretty much. Anything else about that one?
No, I think you covered it really well, and you gave me some really good double feature ideas with it.
Cool. Okay, so now we get into the last two discs, which are the two actually directed by Sam Fuller, written, produced, and directed by Sam Fuller movies. The first of which is The Crimson Kimono from 1959.
Do I get you nervous watching?
It's just that I... Well,
look, a lot of citizens cave in at the last minute when they think their identification might send somebody to the gas chamber.
That's what's bothering me.
You know, you used a lot of little strokes on that kimono paint instead of mixing them up on the palette.
An art critic?
No, I'm just repeating what a friend told me. She called your work total youthful vibration.
Is she an artist?
Yeah, Max an artist. You know, I like the way you look in that smock.
I wish I could have heard that under different circumstances.
You, suppose when you're finished with that sketch that I could have a little more of your time?
You don't look like a cop.
Well, now that word doesn't fit those full lips of yours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, we don't like being called cops. Like girls don't like being called broads.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
May I ask what you want of me?
Strictly police business. On the level.
And this is the one I mentioned before that's basically about... I mean, it's about a murder case. A stripper is murdered, and that is sort of the catalyst for the story of these two cops... again, one Japanese American and one white that were war buddies, and they have this real intimate connection with each other, maybe too intimate, that goes back to like the Japanese character giving his blood to the other guy to keep him alive. So they're like buddies and they live together, which is weird. But I guess in the 50s, it wasn't as weird to have two dudes living together like they do. I think I was talking to you about it and just how funny I thought it was when they're just hanging out in their PJs in the morning. just chatting. But anyway, so a woman kind of comes into the story and it becomes this love triangle thing, and there's this sense of you know, juggling the sort of the issues of the racism that surrounds the Japanese American character and sort of his relationship with his buddy. And yeah, it's a really interesting and complex movie that is really not like any other movie of this kind I've ever seen. I'm not sure about you.
No, although it is interesting that Hiroshima Mono More came out the same year.
Oh,
as
nice.
This.
Did not know that.
But other than that, no, I'm with you.
Yeah, just the mix of, you know, going after sort of what wants to be a well-balanced look at sort of Asian American culture and how difficult it still was to be Asian American in Los Angeles. They're Los Angeles cops, right?
Right.
Yeah, in 1959, post-war. You know, it's just... a story that I feel like only Fuller would tell, at least at this point. Like I think part of his wartime experience was an exposure to Asian culture that ultimately clearly had a huge impact on him and fascinated him in a way that it ended up involving itself in a lot of his films. House of Bamboo, the war films, you know, there's clearly some there too, but he definitely seems kind of obsessed with Asian culture in a really interesting way, in that like he even brings in like this whole kendo ceremony or this whole kendo sparring class / event that the two cops are involved in. There's a lot, there's like some other sort of are they in sort of like the, I guess it's the whole movie takes place in sort of in a more of an Asian part of the city, so there's a lot of like cultural things going on in the movie that are different than your standard cop film of this period, at least as far as I could tell.
Yeah, they actually filmed it in Los Angeles's Little Tokyo.
There we go. Yeah. So, but what are your thoughts on Crimson Kimono?
Oh, I love it.
Great.
I really love it. It has that signature Fuller bombastic beginning with a burlesque show. Dancer gets shot out, and they filmed her. It was a stunt woman, but they filmed her in her like little burlesque stripper getup. just running into the middle of the street and then pretending she was killed. And I guess they actually got actual calls of people saying, like, oh, there's a corpse out here.
Again.
You know how it is.
Saturday.
But I loved the chemistry between our two pajama-clad roommate detectives. It felt so natural, and it was really charming, but you do feel like they had a history together, which once their relationship became so strained, it really was heartbreaking. Sometimes when that happens, especially if they're kind of like fighting over the girl, you can just get so sick of it so quickly. It's just like, let her choose and then go on from there. Just let it go. But this, there's real heartbreak, both friendship-wise and unrequited love. And then you had the racial aspect. And I was just really impressed that they were able to, they showed a full kiss on screen and they were able to tackle this topic. And I was reading into it, and I was expecting him to have really fought for it. And other than them asking, well, can you make the white guy a son of a bitch? So it's really obvious why she'd fall for the Japanese American guy. And he's like, no, she loves him because she loves him. It's not because her only other option's an asshole. Yeah. And I'm so glad he didn't let them change that. But other than that, they're like, yeah, this is a great story. Let's do it.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable for the time.
The marketing was pretty disgusting and misleading.
I didn't watch the trailer.
No, well, it was more like the posters, like...
Oh, yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, how could she fall for a Japanese man and things... Ooh. Yeah, like, just completely not what the film is remotely about, and he was not happy about it. So if you've ever seen one of those posters, please don't hold it against the film.
Yeah, this is weird. I'm looking at the tagline at the top of the poster. It, in bold letters, it says, yes, this is a beautiful American girl in the arms of a Japanese boy.
Yeah.
You know, like that is really, really not so cool. I don't like it. It's very exploitative. And clearly a marketing department that was completely, well, shitty, but also very befuddled by what to do with this movie that was probably not like anything they had ever dealt with prior, that wasn't a straight exploitation film. So I don't know. That's too bad. It is interesting as a...
Yeah, maybe it's as simple as they said, oh, a stripper gets murdered in the first few minutes. All right, it's an exploitation. Just do some shocking about their races or something. Let's go home. I'm going to be generous and assume that was the case.
You may be too generous, but yeah, I think that's definitely a one scenario that could have played out. But yeah, this is a neat movie, and I have for me it was fun because I had gotten into Sam Fuller. I had seen Naked Kiss, Shock Corridor, Big Red One, a few others, but Crimson Kimono was not available at the time, and this was like early 2000s, I want to say.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And yeah, and so I remember it played at UCLA, and a friend of mine and I went and saw it, and it was super cool because it was like a full-on, you know, Sam Fuller Fest kind of movie, you know, just like very Fuller through and through. And it was this one that, you know, we'd never seen before, and it just kind of really hooked us at the time, you know, because of its rareness and because of, you know, everything that it has going on that really makes it Sam Fuller. It definitely got me, and it still does. I love that mix of melodrama and cynicism and idealism. It's so perfectly realized in terms of what Sam Fuller does in this movie. Yeah, it's a blast. It's really interesting too, the way that it ends. You and I were talking about, like, you know, initial interpretations of the ending, and then you just kind of have to, because I guess you have expectations, and it's, you know, it, I don't want to say it doesn't do what you expect it to do, but it does things kind of subtly, which is not what I, that was the part I think I expected the least, was that it would be a little bit subtle about it, sort of.
Okay.
Subtle enough, subtle enough that I'd have to rewatch it. I don't know. Maybe you didn't think it was subtle at all.
No, I lost the track of what you thought was subtle and not subtle a little bit, but.
I didn't want to give away what was subtle and not subtle.
Okay.
I was trying to be vague.
No, I think I'm with you. I'm on the same page.
Sorry. Yeah, so we're both fans of Crimson Kimono, it sounds like.
Yes.
Okay. So then last in this group is a movie called Underworld USA from 1961.
Well, Tolly, if you come up with the reports we want, it'll mean an additional $1,000 for you.
Yeah. Well, it ain't just the money, Mr. Gila. I mean, you know, I can get 1,000 years for cracking that government safe, you know. But I'd like a future with your organization. I don't know. I kind of always wanted some kind of security.
That's the spirit I like. Don't let anything interfere with them.
Oh, are you going to tag along?
What's that?
Oh, no, nothing personal to Gus. It's just that when I operate, I like to operate alone, you know. That way I can...
Concentrate?
Yeah, concentrate.
That's understandable. Leave him alone.
Thank you, Mr. Gia.
But stick close to him.
This one is, like, for me, one that I had seen and one that feels, again, very textbook Sam Fuller-y, but is even slightly darker and meaner than I feel like he got, even in, like, Pick Up on South Street and some others. I don't know how you felt about it in terms of that.
I don't know. I rewatched Pick Up on South Street earlier today. And just the way Gene Peters is treated in that movie, it's brutal.
You're right.
And I just love how Sam Fuller described her as not smart enough to be a hooker. And I was like, come on, guys. Break.
Jeez. Ouch. Okay. Yeah, no, you're right. That character does get not treated particularly well in that movie. Yeah, I can't argue with that. I guess... that this one is even more fatalistic than some of the others. I mean, although fatalism definitely seems a part of his aesthetic, it's definitely something that seeps into a lot of his stories. You just feel a sense of doom for certain characters.
Yeah, no, it's definitely rougher. I do think his cynicism won over, I guess, his more romantic side for this one. And a lot of times that can kind of repel me. As big of a fan of noir as I am, I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm just a bleeding heart. But most of them get to me. And I kind of need to make sure I'm in the right mood to watch them. So I did start watching this. And about 20 minutes in, I'm like, oh, I'm not in the right headspace for this one. So I turned it off. I returned to it the next day. And I think the comparison to Pick Up on South Street is really good. It has kind of a Thelma Ritter-esque, well, just kind of like a motherly figure for people who don't have that in their lives at all.
Oh, yeah. Maternal, yeah.
And I guess he kind of looked at it, you know, juvenile delinquency was a huge topic back then. And he kind of had like a loose trilogy. Very, 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 very loose with this Verboten and 40 Guns. Just just younger characters not having the kind of home life and upbringing they deserved and needed, and kind of showing the ills of how that happened and what that leads to. And there's definitely some propaganda throughout Sam Fuller's films. I can't deny that, but that's such a loaded word. And I feel like it's good propaganda when he does it.
It almost doesn't feel like it is, but it is kind of like it's this Fuller message. You know, it's this Fuller propaganda, I guess. But it's a really interesting it's that melodrama combined with, I guess, the idealism. I don't know what it is, but yeah, it feels like what other films would be pushing off what from other films would come off as just straight propaganda. It does come off that way, but there's something else to
it.
Right.
I do think it part of it is his refusal to paint everyone as completely evil or completely perfect. Everyone's complicated. Your main character will be a jerk sometimes. And, you know, you might see a glimpse into the home life of the heavy and be like, oh, wow, no wonder they're like that. I think Sam Fuller was great at that. And this film, Underworld USA, is pretty much about revenge and the poison of revenge.
Yeah.
The
emptiness.
Yeah. No, and he mentioned he's like, he's too much of a loner to be a gangster. So what happens to you?
Yeah.
When you don't have a gang, but you're kind of, it's you against the world. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's, I'm sorry. I'm not going to say it's bleak.
But it is.
Well, to me, bleakness, it almost comes out of nowhere and offers you nothing.
Okay.
There's enough tender moments in this and sympathy that, boy, I didn't think this one would be so hard to talk about.
No, I get what you're saying about it. You're right about there's...
'Cause this was based on a newspaper article. And I think maybe that's part of it because it doesn't offer easy solutions like a lot of films do.
Yeah.
Sam Fuller wasn't really interested in easy solutions.
Well, I'm sure he just thought they were bullshit. You know, everything's complicated.
He knows they're bullshit. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we should just briefly... The plot is that, you know, a young... hoodlum kid sees his father beaten to death in an alley and sees one of the guys who did it and basically takes that and carries it into his later life when the guy that he knows is part of it ends up going to jail. He gets himself thrown in jail so he can talk to the guy and find out who else was involved in killing his father. And that is his mission, to find out who it was. And that involves him ultimately having to sort of ingratiate himself into another larger criminal organization, and there's kind of a sense of a Yojimbo / Fistful of Dollars kind of playing people against each other kind of thing happening. But ultimately Cliff Robertson, the plays the main guy, Tolly Devlin, ultimately he's just a sad and driven piece of shit.
Yeah, he's really surrendered himself into his vengeance, and no matter where that takes him, no matter what kind of person it turns him into or who it hurts, he's accepted it completely.
Yeah, I mean they set him up as having, I guess, gotten his like insides completely hollowed out by that opening experience. And again, that plays into a lot of Fuller's movies. He, like a journalist, likes to open with something that'll get your attention and then bring you into the story. And that's a pretty powerful opening bit. But yeah, ultimately, I don't know. I have a Cliff Robertson problem.
Okay.
That, you know, this is a stupid art versus artist kind of thing, but this goes, it's within the last 5-6 years, I can't remember. I think it was part of the special. You know what? No, it's in. I think it's in De Palma. It's in the documentary De Palma. So it's only a couple years ago now. He tells a story. De Palma tells a story of Cliff Robertson on Obsession being concerned about getting upstaged by Genevieve Bugeaud, and that he actually went as far as to try and sabotage her performance by drifting on her during a take. Like, he would physically move so that her eye line would shift and so that they couldn't cut the scenes properly. He was basically fucking her up. And I'm sure that kind of thing happens with seasoned actors and younger actors, but that was the first of that kind of despicable behavior that I had heard of, and I just can't forgive him for it. Especially because I love Genevieve Bugeaud. And I just think it's the shittiest fucking thing to do if you're supposed to be a professional, to try and sandbag somebody else's performance. I'm just like, fuck you, Cliff Robertson. So in that way, it actually kind of works in this movie's favor because he is such a son of a bitch.
And I've heard other stories about him being a son of a bitch, too.
It's too bad. It's really too bad. It is. But again, it works for this movie. So,
it's not too bad. Know. Hooray!
No. Yay! Shitty. But yeah, I this is definitely a full on through and through Sam Fuller film. You know, it's it just has the dialogue. It has the sort of sophisticated look at the inner workings of that criminal organization I'm talking about, and some really evil people, you know, just portrayed as evil. Like there's a scene where one of the head guys in this crime organization is talking to some of his lieutenants, basically, and he's talking about,
I've been on the phone to at least 9 cities in the past hour.
About Driscoll?
No, they know he's my headache. They're disappointed in your figures.
I'm stretching the rubber band from coast to coast.
I want to hear it snap. Now, there are at least 13 million kids in this country between the ages of 10 and 15. Don't tell me the end of a needle has a conscience. Put more field men to work around the schools.
And it's just the most evil, awful, you know, gross.
It's almost like an anti-drug PSA, like, hey, we gotta target the kids.
It is that.
You know, I take it back. You're right. It's a bleak movie. Because I just remember the bicycle scene, and yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and I still love your spotting of the first Whole Foods.
Fancy groceries. What else could it be?
It's great. There's just a store that one of the characters is in called Fancy Groceries at one point. But yeah, it's, you know, I think it's not... It's not a Sam Fuller movie I come back to a lot, but when I'm in it, I'm fully in it.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, he really, I don't know. I mean, and the kid they got to play the young Cliff Robertson is astonishingly, at least in my mind, similar looking to the older Cliff himself. I was really amazed at how close they got.
David Kent.
Very good. He did a great job.
Yes, he was fantastic.
Looking like, and he's actually really good. The kid is really good. He's not in the movie that much, but he's good in the parts he's in.
Yeah, well, but you know, it's very important to set that stage, no matter, even if you're not on screen for very long. He had a lot of heavy lifting to get this revenge plot kind of planted.
No, he absolutely did.
I guess Truffaut was a really big fan of this, and how Sam Fuller portrayed children in general, because, you know, the French New Wave filmmakers were always fans of Les Hard-Boiled, you know, the films. But I guess he just...
Your accent is impeccable.
Oh, I know, right?
I was eating a baguette for a second there.
I did take French in high school, and I did very poorly, but... But I guess Truffaut did like the very realistic and sometimes gritty way he portrayed children. Of course, Truffaut did 400 Blows and Small Change, which to me is one of the brightest, darkest films about child neglect I've ever seen in my life.
No, you're right. That's really interesting. I think I knew Truffaut was a fan of Fuller, but I hadn't thought about it from that perspective in terms of bringing that over or being influenced by that particular thing. Totally makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
That's cool. Well, anything else to say about Underworld, or should we dive into the extras on this set? And then we can, I thought we'd go through all of them and then we can talk about highlights, if that's
all right.
Cool.
Yeah, let's dive in.
So on the first disc, back to the 3-film one, there is, I feel like there's not a ton on here. There's something called All-Star Party, which is basically just the party scene that I talked about from It Happened in Hollywood.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is it's the exact scene, but they tell you that those actors actually professionally were like their stand-ins impersonators of them, and they have each of the actors' names. So I guess if you're interested in Hollywood history and you'd actually like to know who the actors were, it gives you their actual information during the scene.
Nice. No, that's cool. It's one of my favorite things in that movie, like I said. There's something called Sam Fuller's Search for the Truth with Tim Robbins.
A filmmaker, that was the last profession he had.
The first two were when he was young. He started in New York as a newspaperman, eventually becoming a crime beat reporter. And he told me, one thing I learned very early on is everybody's lying. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, everyone has their own perception. None of it's true. The mother of the suspect tells a story about this boy that is completely different than the mother of the victim.
I don't think a newspaper has the right to decide the guilt or innocence of anybody. I don't see why we can't get in print both sides of the story about who killed John Carter, who really killed him. I don't see why we can't get in print both sides of every story.
He says, don't trust anybody. You can't trust anybody to get you the truth. You can get snippets of realities, but you'll never know the truth. You have to arrive at that. No one's going to tell you the truth. You'll have to arrive at the truth. And even then, it's a lie. Even then, it's your perception of the truth. And in order to be a good reporter, you have to be able to take all of those different perceptions and try to come up with a story that has some kind of truth to it.
Freedom of the press means freedom to tell the truth. It doesn't mean freedom to twist the truth.
There's such a unique tone to his writing, too. You can tell these weren't made up things. These are things that he must have heard. You know, when you were a crime reporter, you're working and interviewing all kinds of people, but it's usually around some intense drama.
Also my orders. Print the speech I made. On page one. Paper printed speech you wrote for me.
The things you said might have been misconstrued.
You couldn't even wait for me to die.
It's about a 7-minute interview with Tim Robbins talking about Fuller's time as a reporter mostly and how that sort of influenced the filmmaking. And then I think that's it, or on this disc, I think that's it. Yeah. And then on Scandal Sheet and, Shock Proof, there is, I don't think there's anything on that one.
No, I think 'cause they put the three films on one disc.
Yeah.
They didn't try to cram any extras on it.
I think the best extras, we might as well just jump into that. The best extras are in the, they're stretched over both the Crimson Kimono and Underworld USA disc. And it is 12 tapes of like the outtakes, the full interview that Tim Robbins did with Sam Fuller for the typewriter, the rifle, and the movie camera. So the Crimson Kimono disc has tapes 1 through 6, which totals over 3 hours.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And then that carries over into the Underworld USA disc where you have tapes 7 through 12, which is even almost, it's 212 minutes, so 3 hours and round a half. So you've got like something like 6.5 hours of Sam Fuller interview, which is, I mean, talk about a gift that keeps on giving. I just, each one of those, I could sit there and listen to. Okay, if you're not like us, and I can't imagine you wouldn't be, listening to Sam Fuller is just one of the most enjoyable things that you could do. It's, you utterly surrender yourself to him whenever he's telling any story. You're just immediately into the way that he speaks, his voice, how it sounds, and the story that he's telling. And the fact that he's chomping on a cigar. I mean, he's just so amazing. Anyway, that is really cool. I don't know that those outtakes have been available outside of this release. And it's a whole lot of Sam Fuller that, I don't know, I loved.
Yeah, it's incredible. I heard some people say that they were upset these films didn't end up on Criterion. And while I can understand that instinct, trust me, they went, I don't know what, the full Monty? Oh, I lost the fast food thing again. You won't be disappointed. I haven't even listened to all of it yet. I'm going to, but I just can't. I haven't made the full time commitment yet.
Yeah, it's... You can watch it or you could put it on the background because it's usually once they start a section, because there's a play all function on both of them, which is nice. once they start a section, it's a relatively static camera setup. So it's not like you're seeing, you know, you're missing cut-ins to Sam Fuller's face for the most part. It's just, you know, Tim Robbins and him talking. And it's just amazing. Just a lot of extraneous stuff that wouldn't necessarily go into typewriter, but everything he says is just gold. He's got some really remarkable and interesting perspective on so many things, and you get a little bit more of his personal history than I remember being in typewriter, the rifle and the movie camera. So I love to hear about his personal history, because then you're getting sort of the story behind the man that tells the stories. And yeah, he is just a character that I find to be one of my favorites in all of the history of cinema, you know, in terms of the films that he made, in terms of who he is and his personality. He's just so incredible.
I agree. Most interviews I've seen with him, I'm like, oh, can it be a little longer? I want a little more. I'm so happy to have this now. I'm like, oh, put this in. I have a few more hours to listen to.
Right? Yeah, it's great for that. I think it's definitely something that can be savored in that way. And yeah, I was doing that the first couple days. I would just put on a couple chapters of it and, oh man, loved it. So anyway, that is more or less this Sam Fuller set from Indicator. I have talked about their box sets before here. They're mostly been genre stuff, the Sinbad and Harryhausen boxes and the Hammer boxes, and those are great too. In fact, yeah, if you haven't made the plunge with an Indicator box set, you really almost can't go wrong with the ones they've put out so far. But this is among my favorites. I think just because I love Fuller so much and because of the extra material they've added. Yeah, it's really a special package. And I think they're just a really great company. I don't know what your thoughts are in your experience with them so far, Steph.
Well, I'm going to tell you what I really think about them.
Let me have it.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah.
Everything I've seen from them looks stunning. And the extras are very thoughtful. Like, this is stuff full of features, but they're very thoughtfully, you know, put together, and they're great companion pieces to the films. It's really lovely. It's kind of like if you're a total dork like I am, and you sit around being like, wow, what would my dream box set about this person be like? They pretty much got it with Sam Fuller.
Nice.
I guess I would like it if they got John Waters to do a commentary for some reason.
Oh, man.
But that's an unreasonable request, and I won't hold that against them.
Wow. That just blew my mind a little bit. Just thinking about it, that'd be just fantastic to hear him talk about a Sam Fuller movie.
Yeah. There's a reason why I'm not a consultant for these companies.
I think it's a great idea. Just a matter of getting them to do it. But yeah, it's a really great box set, and definitely worth grabbing, I think. And they've got more great stuff on the way. They've got the Night of the Demon set, and they've got the William Castle set coming.
I'm very excited about that. And John Waters is a huge William Castle fan, so
yeah,
get him all over that.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to those. We may have to talk about the Castle box set on the show because I'm really excited about that one. But anyway, Steph, thank you again for doing all the research and watching all these movies and being prepared.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm a huge Sam Fuller fan, and it really is a treat and an honor to be able to talk about him in depth like this. And I wish I was a more elegant speaker, and I apologize for that. This is great. It was fun. I got a lot of my information from his great autobiography, A Third Face, which I've read so many times, and I highly recommend if you have even a passing interest to read it, because it's cracking. Like, he's a fantastic writer, and he's led a fascinating life. So yeah, thank you so much for having me on again.
My pleasure. I we'll have something to talk about real soon, I'm sure. So everybody have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week, and we'll talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.